in Washington. I'm Sue Goodwin.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features Thinking Through C.L.R. James with Matthew Quest, Part 3. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Mwiza Muntali. The music in the background is Water by Ina Moja, commemorating World Water Day, which is March 22nd. Today we present part 3, the final installment of the three-part series, where we are unpacking C.L.R. James's thought, paying specific attention to his articulation of notions of direct democracy, workers' self-emancipation or management, and meditations on autonomy with Matthew Quest. We are intentionally exploring C.L.R. James as a frame of reference in the context of current labor struggles, the opportunities and potential limitations of demands within labor movements, where we think through the limitations of labor demands being divorced from direct critique of imperialism and colonialisms, and how the C.L.R. James's conceptualization of autonomy and direct democracy have an important part to play in conceptualization of labor movements today. First, you'll hear directly from a recording of C.L.R. James, and that's followed by Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope in conversation with Matthew Quest.
You've written eloquently in this period about your friendship and relationship with Paul Robeson.
I knew Paul. And like everybody who knew him, had an immense liking and respect for this magnificent person. He's the most astonishing person I have ever met. Not only he could sing, he was a good actor. He wasn't superb, but his presence, and in addition to all these gifts which impressed the public, he was a marvelous man in private conversation. Paul would speak and speak at length, but he had the faculty that very few have, very few great speakers. He could listen, and he could talk a length of time and then listen to you and keep on listening. So you were never bothered by him. He's an extraordinary human being. He's a man I remember very well, very clearly, and with a great deal of respect and satisfaction.
Did you agree with him politically?
No. I couldn't say that, but I kept away from that. I believe that the Stalinists made more of Paul's association with them than he did. He never said he belonged to anything, but he went along and would refer to them, and they would pick it up as Paul Robeson said. Robeson, Stalinism, the Communist Party, Paul Robeson, they kept that going. But Paul was, if anything, sympathetic to them. But I believe the man I knew was somewhat cautious because he was a public figure. And to commit himself to those people would have been a technical mistake, a social mistake. In addition, personally, well, they're ready. They were Paul Robeson all the time. If you listen to them, you would believe. But he, even talking to me, he would say, well, you know, C.L.R., leave it there.
Of course, Robeson played Toussaint Louverture.
Yes.
He played
Toussaint Louverture. That was before I went to the United States. That was in Britain here. And I wrote the play before I published The Black Jacobins. I don't know what was in my head. And then somebody saw it and told me. So I used to, everybody used to talk to Paul and be glad to be in his company. In the 30s, it was very difficult, you know. Black people were isolated, there were so few of us. So I used to meet him periodically. We'd have some tea somewhere or something. Some people talk. So I met him and I told him, by the way, I have a play, you know. And people think that you do very well. I think so too. He says, well, let me see it. And in those days, there weren't many plays in which a leading part would be played by a black man. So he read it and told me, yes, I would. And from there it went.
That was written before Black Jackman
absolutely
was published.
Written
but the
before.
Whole conception of Black Jackman.
The conception was there, but I had written essays here and there and I delivered lectures.
I mean, people now talk about Black Jacobins as an important historical book, but really, it was also a thesis about contemporary black politics, wasn't it?
It was, and politics that is fundamental is always applicable to different periods of history, because fundamental politics always has behind it the struggle of different classes. Different sections of the class can struggle and kill one another, but that is not much a social event as when one social structure is fighting against another part of the social structure. Certain logical and historical things emerge which are applicable to similar periods, 1,000 years before or after.
But what is the significance of Toussaint Louverture for you? I mean, how do you see the connection between those events in Haiti then and the 20th century politics?
I have already said during the last few minutes that any great revolutionary event in history, from it you can always find principles and historical movement ideas that apply to others. I was saying that before. Now, that is so in any great revolution, and the San Domingo Revolution was the first great revolution of black people. Now, when you consider the role that Africa was going to play in the world in the years to come, that then acquires a significance. Furthermore, it was a part of the French Revolution. So that you have in that historical event a duality in which it takes part in the great revolutions is very important. The first was the British. And at the same time, it points the finger to the revolutions among colonial peoples. So that that revolution is something that is worthy of consideration by every type of historian. If even you study the French Revolution, that is the extreme point of the French Revolution in Europe. But at the same time, it's the beginning of the colonial upheavals. So that is, from the point of view of the historian, a significant, in fact, a dominating feature of the study of history.
That's a wonderful connection. But for you, it's not just by chance that that happens in the Caribbean, is it?
The important thing, as far as I'm concerned, is the date of my first book, The Black Jacobins. It is 1938. That's to say, it is before World War II and all that took place after. It, somehow or other, I believe, well, I don't want to go into this, but I believe it is the fact that I'm from the Caribbean.
Why do you attribute it to that, though?
Not
1938 is a very important year in the Caribbean, after all.
Yes,
it's
but
that, coming to consciousness of the Caribbean labor movement.
But I don't want to go into that because it will lead me too far.
In 1938, C.L.R. James went to the United States for what turned out to be a major phase of his political life, but which at the time he thought would only be.
Matthew Quest and C.L.R. James and George Patmore, Hidden Disputes in the Black Radical Tradition, examines the collaboration between James and George Patmore since their partnership within the International African Service Bureau in the 1930s. Despite their joint activism in Pan-African affairs, political rifts emerged on democracy, socialism, and revolutionary strategy. Quest specifically explores James's portrayal of Patmore to highlight the political tensions underlying their friendship. James's and Patmore's different perspectives on anti-imperialism reveal hidden disputes in the Black radical tradition, disputes that promoted evolution in thought and practice that must be taken up today. In London during the 1930s, the era of the Italian invasion of Ethiopia, C.L.R. James and George Patmore worked together as activists in the International African Service Bureau. Quest goes on to highlight that in 1957, a plan was hatched in Britain for Patmore to become chief of staff of Pan-African Affairs in Kwame Nkrumah's Ghana, and James to become the editor of The Nation, the organ of Eric Williams' People's National Movement, but also the secretary of the effort to federate the West Indies from 1958 to 1962. When Patmore passed away, C.L.R. James began to write him into history. Accordingly, we must never forget that C.L.R. James first codified the framework of the Black radical tradition in Party Politics in the West Indies, 1962. He called it a tradition of anti-colonial national talent. But he underscored, you don't understand the tradition or archive unless you grasp the antagonisms and debates within it. Many of the current, quote, expert or scholars on Pan-Africanism and communism still cannot discern these hidden disputes and spread an anemic intellectual project that is adjusted to their own professional development and accumulation of social capital. Keep in mind, James's and Patmore's friendship of many years assisted each other in surviving the political wilderness. They theorized and led a great social movement that many doubted until, in a certain sense, what Richard Wright first termed Black Power began to arrive on its own authority as part of the age of third world national liberation struggles. George Patmore was the Moscow coordinator of international solidarity efforts with Black workers for the Communist International and editor of the Negro Worker. James's Notes on the Life of George Patmore, an unpublished manuscript, is the basis for many published essays and public lectures. Patmore, among the canon of heroic representative men which James began to manufacture, holds his place in historiography largely as a result of James's singular effort to place narratives of his life as central to the Black radical tradition. James often tried, with his Patmore narratives, to teach his audience lessons about the problems of thin conceptions of democracy, socialism, and national liberation. Though his audiences frequently failed to understand all the facets of James's Patmore stories. Though this shouldn't be taken as a small matter, when James is misunderstood, he is generally assumed to be simply imparting lessons about Black autonomy and political organization. C.L.R. the Elder was not always able to rigorously explain, save the most attentive, where he came from politically. James began to recognize the fact that for youth who wanted him to tell stories about the Black radical tradition, chronicles which included George Patmore, the distinctions of ideological and party affiliation among red and Black were irrelevant. It was all communism because the white racists and capitalists said so, and because conservatives appeared to be threatened by such ideas. The next generation did not understand that many of the old left had also came to this conclusion, to the qualitative detriment of how one viewed white workers, imperial nations, and national liberation in colonized nations. This conflict between worker self-management, increasingly seen as a, quote, white idea, in metropolitan centers and national liberation struggles, tore apart the last manifestation of the Facing Reality Group, James's last small revolutionary organization in 1970. This was expressed through internal uncertainty about where Mao Zedong and Kwame Ture were going. Ironically, it was at this moment the direct democracy tendency in the Caribbean left in Trinidad, Antigua, Guyana, Grenada, and Jamaica, many who met each other in Canada, and certain dissident currents in Detroit's League of Revolutionary Black Workers began to see the merits of direct democracy and workers' self-management for Black post-civil rights and post-colonial revolt. These are evidence of other hidden disputes in the radical tradition stimulated by C.L.R. James. Today we present part 3, the final installment of our 3-part series where we unpack C.L.R. James's thought, paying specific attention to his articulation of notions of direct democracy, workers' self-emancipation and management, and meditations on autonomy with Matthew Quest. We intentionally explore C.L.R. James as a frame of reference in the context of current labor struggles, the opportunities and potential limitations of demands within labor movements, where we think through the limitations of labor demands being divorced from direct critique of imperialism and colonialism. And how does C.L.R. James's conceptualization of autonomy and direct democracy have an important part to play in conceptualization of labor movements today? Matthew Quest is an editor of Clash, a collective of writers who advocate for Caribbean unity from below. He has taught African, African-American, and Caribbean history at universities in the United States. He is known as a scholar of the legacies of C.L.R. James. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities in Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Listen intently, think critically, act accordingly.
All over the world, there was a Detroit, Kenya Sunday in churches and black churches, but in Nehru's India, in Jamaica and Trinidad and Britain and France, this pamphlet was circulated widely through their networks, the activist networks in Ghana. So now Ghana, CLR gives a speech and he's visiting. At that time in 1960, he was editor of Eric Williams' People's National Movement publication, The Nation. He was the editor and working and advising with Eric Williams, and just as he was advising Nkrumah in the period 19, obviously he writes letters and is friendly, but he's most engaged in both from like 1957 to 66. Okay? But after 60-61, he becomes in opposition to Williams. Of course, with Ghana, he visits. He visits the independence in 57. He visits in 1960 to give a speech. And the 1960 speech, while it tries to separate out Nkrumah's personality from the policies that the party, the Convention People's Party, has been advocating, he says something very peculiar. He says, an underdeveloped country has to gather as much capital as it can while it says to the world, we're trying to overthrow the relations of capital. So in this context, CLR expresses something that he periodically expressed also in the arena of Caribbean Federation politics in the same period. A type of vision of state capitalism that could be perceived as, well, obviously he was not promoting it as something hostile to workers. He was promoting it as something that was perceived as breaking up the former plantation or colonial dependent order from the point of view of the state planning of the economy by the person that holds the reins of the nation state. One of the silences in his Nkrumah and the Ghana Revolution book, which I've been developing, is while he placed a greater emphasis on direct democracy and the social motion of African workers in the anti-colonial movement as he depicts it from 1947 to 1951, in the period where he's consulting and advising and promoting Nkrumah's rule, he is silent about the 1961 general strike against Nkrumah. And the 1961 general strike is led by the same Ghanaian labor personalities that were central to the positive action general strike that brought Nkrumah to power. And they were later purged by Nkrumah's early policies. So the three major labor personalities, perhaps that are most famous, the leader, it would be Paul B. Biney, and forgive me if I don't pronounce all these, Ghana names can be tough sometimes. There's Turkson Okron, right? and it was Anthony Wood. And so they were also prison graduates. But CLR only gave Bonnie one sentence in his increment in the Ghana Revolution, and he talked not at all about the 1961 general strike. Now, the 1961 general strike, some people associate with the Ashanti elitist opposition parties. They presented themselves under two rubrics, what they called the National Liberation Movement. That was the name of a party, NLM, and the United Party. And this was, you know, the personalities. Dankwa, J.B. Dankwa, wrote a Khan, Doctrine of God. Joe Appiah, who's the father of Kwame Anthony Appiah, the philosopher, right? And K.A. Busia, who later became prime minister. So these people are were perceived as collaborating with the neo-colonial British. And but these strike action was not collaborating with the these forces, but they were equally anti-American and Russian influences. So the silences about this strike in discussing Nkrumah, what went wrong with Nkrumah, because we know CLR is famous for being the first prominent personality of the Pan-African left to critique or break with Nkrumah in 1964 in public, right? That he's overthrown, Nkrumah's overthrown in 66. Mm-hmm. But CLR was silent about a lot of contradictions, and some of his private letters, he even encouraged Nkrumah to make sure to contain the labor movement, which in fact he did. Right? So CLR, the great advocate of labor self-emancipation, his Leninist interpretation of what to do when state power was in the hands did not point the way forward to having labor be central to the post-colonial new society.
What did he learn from that? What did he learn as he's moving forward? What was the lesson that you think that he was able to kind of gather from that particular contradiction itself?
Well, I think that there's a perception that as he moves on to being an international supporter of Julius Nyerere's Tanzania, that he starts to talk more openly about the problems of state capitalism and the problems that the African workers and farmers want to govern themselves. But he continues to be, and this gets to the question of coalition again, if he's a fellow traveler of the African statesman, while he is fond of taking a document like the Kanu Declaration, Arusha Declaration, right, or the Mwongozo Guidelines, he likes to take a political manifesto and interpret it to the public, the world stage, and say, this is what the Trinidad or this is what the Tanzania Party government is trying to do. And then it says, you know, everybody in the party has to be a peasant or worker. Nobody can have live by rent. Nobody can have two or more salaries. And he says, if they implemented this in all party politics all over the world, we'd have a new society, right? So he's saying, he's giving Nyerere credit for promoting these types of ideas, and also what he says is a non-racialism as the basis of Ujamaa socialism. But the thing is that anybody who's serious about scholarship on Tanzania in this period knows that these manifestos in no way shake the law or implemented anything. And in fact, the vision of Ujamaa socialism became a compulsory authoritarian state plan. It was initiated in one village in the so-called Rovuma district. Maybe they called themselves the Rovuma Development Association. But there was a sense that they took the initiative to be somehow a self-governing commune of a certain type, these peasant farmers. And there was a confusion. There was a perception that Nyerere was a patron of them and encouraged them personally. But then his state, his party, repressed them. And then subsequently, Nyerere used the ideals of Ujamaa socialism that he apparently saw in the Rovuma Development Association and generalized that to a state plan. And what that basically meant was he didn't want peasants living far apart if he was going to give them community wells or if he was going to provide medical attention or build infrastructure. So he wanted people, instead of being spread apart over a mountainous area, to leave where they were and to live concentrated around the infrastructure he was going to provide. And then because people couldn't be convinced to do that, you know, one of the more repressive aspects of Ujamaa socialist planning was that, you know, people's homes were bulldozed. You know, I mean, obviously people had modest homes, you know, ramshackle, corrugated roof, hut, little, you know, maybe a concrete slab, you know, on the bottom if they're lucky, right? So in the movement for the 6th Pan-African Congress, there were activists that began to question how the 6th Pan-African Congress and Pan-African Solidarity was framed, because people were looking for science and technology aid to Africa, but they were seeing it from a point of view of what professionals could lend to the bureaucracy of the government, which is, you know, consistent with the World Health Organization, you know, those types of things, you know, Doctors Without Borders, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, the perception, there was no people's history of science and technology among these middle class and professional Pan-Africanists when they looked at the peasantry and the pastoralists. So they're projecting their dreams of self-determination and self-government from above onto the African continent. They see Nyerere as their president or their government, but their interaction with peasant farmers and pastoralists, but also many, you know, not surprisingly, just like in Ghana, many industrial workers, right? A lot of people say, well, if it's a peasant society, there's not many industrial workers, but there were factory workers, there were railway workers, there were ports, maritime workers, right? Dock workers. And these were some of the Africans with the most highest and consistent wages if they were unionized. So by 1974-75, for those that are familiar with the left literature on Tanzania, class struggles in Tanzania, and then there was also a pamphlet that came before that was very similar by Issa Shivji. Those recorded the wildcat strikes of workers and farmers against the bureaucratic trade unions as organized by Nyerere's state. That's something that was happening in Ghana, but nobody in the international left wanted to speak to it. So the problem when we talk about historical moments is that it is true that there's a rise and fall and appearance and disappearance of certain rebellions, and they have certain limitations. But the point of having a philosophy of history and cultivating the popular will, and CLR says this also in relation to his Marxism, he says, once something happens in the world, it has happened for the whole epoch. Because we're functioning in one world. The Cold War thinker divides the world into blocks of capital and cheers on, you know, the peripheral bourgeoisie of their favorite nation and says, look, they have their own bank. They have their own industry. Isn't this kind of like socialism where they ain't thinking about the workers at all, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people like that.
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying politics and revolutionary politics functions in one world. So if the workers and farmers say they want to govern themselves in Tanzania, even if Nyerere says, well, they want to govern themselves, but they're not fit to govern themselves, CLR says this is a, you know, a major turning point, and we're waiting for the next development and political thought to come out of this contradiction. Of course, if you're not a fellow traveler of the government, you don't got to wait. It's already there, right? It doesn't have to be perfect. So that's why that's a good time when we talk about the Zapatistas or Rojava or Occupy, you know, or the public square movements, you know, to say, okay, we know that great insurgent initiatives can happen, and it doesn't mean that all contradictions have been resolved. But as long as you see yourself as a fellow traveler of a state that's progressive, you're going to be somewhat embarrassed or uncomfortable with insurgency against them. And you're going to look around and try to say, well, are the imperialists sponsoring this? Is it a fascist development? Is it a progressive development? You know, because that's not really the end goal of most people's politics. The end goal of most people's politics is to beautify a nation, state, or republic.
You're listening to part three, the final installment of the three-part series where we are unpacking C.L.R. James's thought, paying specific attention to his articulation of notions of direct democracy, workers, self-emancipation or management, and meditations on autonomy with Matthew Quest. Matthew Quest is an editor of Clash, a collective of writers who advocate for Caribbean unity from below. He has taught African, African-American, and Caribbean history at universities in the United States. The music in the background is Mai by Chino Iso Marere, and we play that commemorating her birthday, which is March 5th, and also Women's History Month. For frequent listeners of Africa Now, Chino Iso Marere is no stranger to Africa Now. As you know, the theme song for the show, Banarapa, is by Chino Iso Marere. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW, 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
So we have some of these contradictions, and he expressed similar contradictions in his orientation to Cuba and China. But I want to emphasize that there are elements to his Marxism and Leninism that holds him back, I believe. But we can't make it seem like if he has the perfect ideas and the perfect strategy, you just drop him or us or anybody down in the middle of a country or a culture that they're a foreigner to, and that somehow they're responsible for overcoming all contradictions and changing the world by themselves, you know? So I think CLR as a public, I hate to use the word public intellectual, but as a cultivator of the popular will, who's also known as a historian and a philosopher, he's able to stir debate and start conversations. And he thinks, well, if he writes down his philosophy and it's clear and people know what it is, it's the other people that are betraying, because he's not going to betray his own principles. So there's some truth in that. That's where he's a kind of like a Rousseauian social contract theorist. He's saying, okay, James, we've been talking. We say we have common ground. Let's associate. Let's write down our principles. okay, let's begin to propagandize or organize. All right, whoever abandons the principles first, that's a problem. The goal is to stay loyal to the terms of association. And a lot of people find that utopian and say, well, that's not how the Machiavellian world of politics works. It's not like you go to a conference, present a paper, and therefore the world is what you want it to be. But are you trying to bring a new society closer that's ethical and transparent and democratic or not? So it's remarkable how people see CLR as a George Lamming liked to say, he was an evangelist, both good and bad, that he talked about history and historical revolutions like he was there, and that he knew every intimate situation and strategic question. And then he said, but at a certain point, why does he think Nkrumah or Eric Williams are going to listen to him like when he was mentoring them when they were younger? So they make it seem like CLR is not humble. There's another question I don't know if you thought about. Is CLR egomaniac? Is he humble? People have said you wouldn't say CLR is humble. That gets to the question of people think FDR is humble. They think Lenin is humble. You know that people have said that, right? Like a personality above society can be seen as benevolent or patrician or on the side of the people, and therefore they're humble, but someone with a lot of big ideas, they're utopian and stratospheric and arrogant. But CLR said, I'm not going to run for office. I'm not going to be a prime minister. I'd rather be dog catcher. So his conception of politics is to be the cultivator of the working class or the oppressed nation, to help them rearrange society. So even if he hasn't resolved all the contradictions after his intervention, he leaves things more popular democratic than when he left, when he first got there, when he first saw, you know, what was going on.
Mm-hmm. So as we come to a pause, because there's many different things I have, you know, some, but I want us to touch on two things. One of them is, you know, his interaction with Detroit working, revolutionary movements working there. Because of course, you know, in the, Medebo, Kandali, and, Kemathi Muhammad, who also are critiquing at the six pack, right? Looking at this elitist notion of science and technology. I want to talk about CLR James's interaction in Detroit, because I think that that is a formative part as well in his expansion, or him developing, you know, these very, very, what some people may say grassroots, but it's direct democracy. Again, looking at workers at the center. And then what I wanted to do as we kind of move after we engage that, what are two things, if someone was listening to this conversation, some workers are listening to this conversation, what are two things that are very important that they should be thinking about or taking away from this very, very robust, wide-ranging conversation? And we talked about it conceptually, but I just want to kind of summarize it for someone who was listening to this, who are thinking about it in the context of their work in labor movement today.
Okay.
So we'll start with Detroit.
Okay. So we talked a little bit about FDR's New Deal, and FDR, the age of FDR corresponds roughly to the age of the CIO labor movement. And CLR, with his comrades in the Johnson Forest Tendency and later the Correspondence Group and the Facing Reality Group, thought it was important to reorient from, you know, places where there was a lot of cultural and intellectual debate like New York City to Detroit, even though, of course, New York City in the 30s and 40s was far more industrial than it is now. Detroit was considered the center of the industry. And so the age of the CIO labor movement, we have to, which originally was the Committees for Industrial Organization that ruptured with the American Federation of Labor and later reconstituted itself as a bureaucracy, as the Congress of Industrial Organizations, and refederated with the AFL. This is the origin of the National Federation of Most Trade Unions in America. They're affiliated with the AFL, so-called AFL-CIO, right? So in the early 30s, in response to the Great Depression, there were great, again, periods of general strikes, wildcat strikes, unemployed workers' council movements, sharecropper revolts. And so off the top of my head, there were general strikes, and four general strikes in 1934 alone. There was the Toledo, Ohio auto workers. There was the Minneapolis Teamsters. There was the San Francisco, Oakland Bay dock workers. And there was across the southern borders, there were the textile workers in the Carolinas and Georgia and Alabama. So there was general strikes going on, major general strikes that took over cities and states in 1934 by people who were industrial, who were working and producing and distributing, right? The truck drivers, the maritime workers, they're distributing. The auto workers, they're producing. The textile workers, they're producing. So in this period from 1933 really to 1947, there are great strikes all over the country. And there's a period of repression initially with the beginning of World War II, because the trade union hierarchies signed no strike pledges with the government. And then during World War II and after, there were de facto wildcat strikes and sit-in strikes all over. So in Ford, Chrysler, and Chevrolet plants and Cadillac plants, there was a mass migration of Southern African Americans, the sharecropper roots, to these industrial jobs during the age of the CIO. One of the claims of the anti-racism of the CIO movement was there were obviously there were still obvious ugly limitations to white supremacy in the U.S., including in the North. And there was a major white race riot in 1943 in Detroit. So Detroit has always been a place when it was at its industrial height where there was the prospects of multiracial association. There were prospects for Black people to get comfortable and steady employment and increasing pensions. And there was also a white supremacist backlash that could be present in Detroit. But of course, Detroit in the 30s and 40s was multiracial and predominantly white. And by the early, late 60s and early 70s, the age of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, you have an overwhelming majority Black city. And today, there's very few white people that live within the city of Detroit since, you know, late 80s, early 90s, as far as I know. So, of course, you have gentrification. You have some white folks moving back. But the distinction between the CIO movement and the transition from the CIO to the age of civil rights and anti-colonialism has caused a lot of debate about CLR and his politics, particularly in relation to the split with James and Grace Lee Boggs, whose politics began to shift drastically in the early 60s. So the Boggs are seen in coalition with the people that built the New African Movement and the people that built RAM, Revolutionary Action Movement, and the people that, Uhuru, and people that built League of Revolutionary Black Workers. The Boggs, like CLR and CLR Circle, are seen as mentors, but overwhelmingly in Detroit, as led by the trade union bureaucracy, right, was led by Orthodox communists or social democrats. right? So CLR's ideas, while they might have had a radical caucus within the UAW at a certain point in time and influence with some one or two of their comrades, they participated in the labor movement, and they had a critique of trade union bureaucracy, but they never really led any specific workplace struggle or labor struggle. They gave support. They took part when it happened, right? But there are people that maintain a certain amount of ideas. Now, along with this age of the CIO, we have to recognize there's four major national labor personalities. I'm sure there's more, but this is just to keep it simple, right? There's John L. Lewis of the miners. There is the man who led, I'm trying to remember his name, the man that led the San Francisco, Oakland Bay dock workers. He was a communist. I'm trying to remember his name. There was Sidney Hillman, who was the major labor bureaucrat that advised the New Deal. He was the textile industry in New York, the needle trades, not textile, needle trades, right? And then there's, of course, Walter Reuther's CIO. Walter Reuther's UAW, United Auto Workers. So Walter Reuther was seen as an ally of the Southern Civil Rights Movement, and some of the monies from the trade union hierarchy, the CIO, went into the March on Washington and other things like that. But the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, when it emerges in response to the Detroit uprising of 67, and it exists from 69 to 71, it's responding to the Wildcat strike at the so-called Dodge Revolutionary Union movement, where General Baker became prominent. We talked about General Baker the other day, right? So there is the League of Revolutionary Black Workers is the most proletarian-oriented black power organization, but it exists in an environment where people's conception of labor had declined. So the kind of ideas associated with CLR about direct democracy and worker self-management that preceded the modern civil rights movement. In other words, Montgomery is happening as the CIO is becoming bureaucratized and declines. So there's a sense that the labor movement was one thing from the 30s to the mid-50s, and then the age of civil rights and anti-colonialism is a transition where the Boggs feel that you can't focus on these workers, James and Grace Lee Boggs, because they've been bought off with their pensions and their higher wages and consumer privileges and, you know, new household items like washing machines and things like that. And of course, automation is minimizing mass labor. So they start to identify with Nkrumah and Mao and Cabral and basically third world vanguardists and state planners as bringing the new society forward. And of course, the late Malcolm, right, 63, 64, 65, but they knew Malcolm before he left the Nation of Islam. So they're forerunners of the Black Power movement, assuming that the Black Power movement officially gets started after Malcolm's death, right? So 62, 63, 64, 65. And the conception of labor increasingly is seen as white, where previously labor was seen as multiracial, but not a Black autonomous force. So the League of Revolutionary Black Workers emerges not so much advocating worker self-management and workers' control, but a kind of Black power, third world, anti-imperialist perspective. So there were some people in the League that wanted to build a multiracial communist party. There were some people in the League that wanted to build a Black nationalist or all-Black party. And then there were some people that vaguely had a sense that, you know, we should be building workers' councils in the factories. But it was a very vague idea. If you ever watch Finally Got the News with, I see him with the glasses, John, you know what I'm talking about?
Is it Kenneth Cark? It's not Kenneth Cockrell, well, is it?
Yeah, there's the people who, in the Kenneth Cockrell, but Kenneth Cockrell has an afro and is big and heavy.
Right, right, right.
There was a younger guy who works with, he worked with the Wayne State University paper, and before he created the Drum newspaper, and John something, why can't I remember? And then anyway,
go ahead.
Yeah, but in the Finally Got the News, he's the one talking about a general strike, that if black workers got together, they could take over Detroit through a general strike. And that was, if you knew that the Uhuru guys that helped build the league, they had did study groups with the Boggs, with Marty Glaberman, who was James's comrade, right? So they would have read stuff and been dialoguing with stuff about the prospects, but their conception of power was such that they still hadn't decided to discard identifying with the mayor. And so most of them went into supporting in some way, in a black united front, the election of Coleman Young as the first black mayor in 73, right? 72, 73.
We've just been listening to a portion of part three, the final installment of the three-part series where we are unpacking C.L.R. James's thought, paying specific attention to his articulation of notions of direct democracy, workers' self-emancipation or management, and meditations on autonomy with Matthew Quest. We're intentionally exploring C.L.R. James as a frame of reference in the context of current labor struggles, the opportunities and potential limitations of demands within labor movements, where we think through the limitations of labor demands being divorced from direct critique of imperialism and colonialism. And how does C.L.R. James's conceptualization of autonomy and direct democracy have an important part to play in the conceptualization of labor movements today? Matthew Quest is an editor of Clash, a collective of writers who advocate for Caribbean unity from below. He has taught African, African American, and Caribbean history at universities in the United States. The full conversation between Matthew Quest and African Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope will be available on African Now's SoundCloud page. That's African Now Online. And that will be part 1, 2, and 3. Will be available on African Now SoundCloud page. That's African Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Fortify by Nubia Garcia. That's it for African Now for today. I'm your host, Muiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shah Nana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at the situation in Palestine and the rest of North Africa and the Middle East. And that's followed by the women's collective, Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by Human Rights and Justice with Nikisha Taifa, which is followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, and which is followed by Kombita Kai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Again, that's Africa Now Online on Facebook and on Twitter. And Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope, and thanks to our engineer Michael Nicella, and thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Koza and Funa Ngonda, and our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Utterson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW, and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Think by Aretha Franklin, commemorating her birthday, which is March 25th, and Women's History Month. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay stay safe.
WPFW News in Washington, NWBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, March 27th. Here are some headlines. A report released today estimates that 19% of the food produced around the world went to waste in 2022. According to the UN Environment Program's Food Waste Index report, that's equivalent to about 1.05 billion metric tons of food. The report found that the biggest contributor to the total was households, which accounted for 60% of food waste. Around 30% came from food services, such as restaurants, and the remaining came from retailers. The report comes at a time when 783 million people around the world face chronic hunger, and many places are facing deepening food crises. It also comes amid growing concern about the environmental toll overall of food production and the greenhouse gas emissions it produces. The UN report estimates that approximately 8% to 10% of global greenhouse gas emissions are due to food waste and loss. In more news from the United Nations, Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, told the UN's Human Rights Council yesterday that she believed that Israel's military campaign in Gaza since October 7 amounted to genocide. The 1948 Genocide Convention, enacted in the wake of the Nazi Holocaust, defines genocide as, quote, acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group, close quote. During the briefing, Albanese stated, quote, I find there are reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating the commission of the crime of genocide against Palestinians as a group in Gaza has been met, close quote. She called on countries to immediately impose sanctions and an arms embargo. Israel did not attend the session and rejected her findings. In domestic news, the U.S. Coast Guard late yesterday transitioned from an active search to a recovery effort for six construction workers who are now presumed dead and who were on Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge when it collapsed yesterday after one of its support pillars was struck by a container ship that lost power. Meanwhile, the National Transportation Safety Board has recovered the ship's black box data recorder, which will help develop a timeline of events leading up to the crash as investigators seek to understand what caused it. President Biden said he expects the federal government will pay for the entire cost of rebuilding the bridge, which could take up to a year. The president called on Congress to support efforts to fund the repairs. Speaking to the larger impact of the catastrophe, U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg warned yesterday that the ongoing closure of a crucial East Coast shipping channel will not be felt just at the local level, but on a macro scale. Speaking at a news conference, he said, quote, The port here in Baltimore does the most vehicle handling of any port at all. You also have container traffic, you have boat traffic. There is no question that this will have a major and protracted impact on supply chains. Close quote. And in weather today in Washington, it is 48 degrees under rainy skies. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm BAI in New York. I'm Sue Goodwin.